Blog Talk Radio.
Come to the door of Masonic Companion. Welcome to this edition, the 15th of June 2014, 166th day of the year. It's always a pleasure to have you here. Interesting show today. I think there's no possible way that I can be less than optimistic and candid about things Masonic. This is a meal best savored slowly and gradually, I think. Don't you? It's not something that you can gorge on every single day unless you've, I think, have lost it a bit. I think we need to keep all of the things that we're doing into some kind of context. Even to ignore the peacocks that prance around us and, have that sense of, that the beautiful moments when you see a fellow who's discovered some sense of self-importance. It's like, oh, this is, nobody else can tell. I'm all being, all seeing, all knowing. It's wonderful. We all have to go through that, I think. Hopefully we go through it when we're boys. But, it's more grand when we're older. Interesting show. Coming up today, we're going to talk about some reflections on the nature of Freemasonry. But I was absolutely pleased to get the newsletter called Chips, and it's produced by the Heritage Lodge. The article, I think, is 84. It's the May edition, volume 23, number 2, if any of you subscribe to Heritage Lodge. Really is an interesting organization, I think. But this newsletter work, single page by the editor, Brother Sheldon Kofsky, is quite gripping. He talks to us about Masonic scholars, philosophy, and research. And he notes a very, very simple. Some say, if you don't mind, Sheldon, some may say we have four systems of Masonic philosophy. Two are intellectual. First, that of Preston, whose key word is knowledge. Second, that of Krauss, whose key word is morals. Two are spiritual systems, that of Oliver, whose key word is tradition. And second, that of Pike, whose key word is symbolism. I apologize, the paragraph itself is a bit choppy, as you can tell. It's full of idea, but I think it really does pop out. It really does grab us. And of course, immediately I'm ashamed to myself. I would argue this keyword sense, but he's making a point. There has come to be a well-defined branch of Masonic learning, he says, which has to do with certain fundamental questions. And those questions may be called the problems of Masonic philosophy, since that branch of Masonic learning which treats them has been called the philosophy of Masonry. Again, let's see where that thread takes us. Just be patient here. First, he says, what is the nature and purpose of Freemasonry as an institution? For what does it exist? What does it seek to do? Of course, for the philosopher, this involves the questions, what ought Masonry to be? for what ought it to exist and what ought it to seek as its end. That was a little, just consider that intellectual gristle here. And then what is and what should be the relation of masonry to other human institutions? I'm just sort of stretched a little bit. What other kind of institutions are there? But especially to those directed towards similar ends. I think as we get into the discussion with our brother Kofsky, then the nature of that might become a little clearer. But just think, this is really, really an interesting mind here that's putting something down on paper that we don't usually see. Let's get back to the safety of the square and compasses and gavels and tracing boards and things like that. But here we have it. What is its place in the logical scheme of human activities? Now that's kind of a, you know, that is a bit of appeal for to me. What, and then the last portion of this, fourths and thirds and seconds and whatever. What are the fundamental principles by which masonry is governed in attaining the end it seeks? Now that, I think, all the rest of the stuff I just find is a bit tedious, but that one really, it was quite good. Three striking features of the beginning of the 18th century in England, he says, are the importance of an understanding of Preston's philosophy of masonry. It was a period of mental calm. Both in England and elsewhere, it was a period of formal over-refinement. And it was the so-called age of reason, when the intellect was taken to be self-sufficient and men were sure that knowledge was an answer. I would have begun to think that was Greece. Anyway, there you have it. We should be grateful to the effort. And wouldn't you? I think we could all agree. We'd love to sit down with this fellow and pick up the conversation where it lets off. We're coming up to the 22nd of, we're only a week away, aren't we? The 22nd of we're coming up to summer solstice. Quite interesting time of year. It's on the 21st of June, that's Saturday this year, at 10:51 UTC, whatever the heck that means. That means 6:51 a.m. at our time. So where I'm sitting on the planet, and the countdown to the June solstice here, it's 5 days, 22 hours, 42 minutes and 53 seconds, 52 seconds, 51. So I'm basking here in 15 hours and 32 minutes and 28 seconds of sunlight today. It's only going to stretch out another 3 minutes at solstice. But, those 3 minutes count. They warm us. They get the seeds, warm up the soil so the seeds will germinate. And I keep thinking of the Babylonians and the Egyptians and early Mesopotamians, people that looked at the sun and the universe with awe, sun and the moon with awe, and why shouldn't we be any different? Why should we be any different? It's an amazing. Our explorers are out there trying to just see what's going on around us, but I think gives any thoughtful person a sense of a sense of perspective. So we have that coming up. I hope you'll be one of those people that will be there at 6:51 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. That's wonderful to be alive in this period. We're going to mix in a bit of music today, like we try to always, and we have a topic du jour. Things are going well in masonry for you, I would consider. Things we do I'm becoming want to talk to you a bit and get some advice from you about some of the phenomena, the things that I can't help but notice. And it's about this, something that still gnaws at me, and I guess you know if you've been tuning in fairly regularly that I address this and talk about this in different ways and shapes and forms over the years now. That feeling that we've lost the grandeur, we've lost something that we had before. We were once something significant. And I began to wonder if I just, whether I agree with it, that puzzles me, but it posed an interesting exercise for me to assume in my thinking that I did agree with it, that there was something in the past that we have lost other than the genuine secrets. Maybe this is one of them. Then what? Quite frank, to be frank with all of you, any listener, I believe that the zenith of Freemasonry is not behind us, but it's ahead of us. Maybe the heyday of Masonry for some is in the past, and you know, the lodges of the origins of institutional organization, those things are important. Grand lodges, absolutely important for us to be protected from the outside world, just for those moments when we need to conduct ourselves in a thoughtful way according to certain rules of conduct and thought and expectation. It's in that way, it's artificial. But we do it for a particular reason. There's nothing really natural about that. But we have realized that, you know, if we posture this way, put ourselves in that posture, there's things that come a little clearer to us. Not without work. But not that they can't be done other ways, but it is a way for groups of men to be able to share and work with ideas. This hasn't been, it's no different, I think, in my mind, than the work of the Kratos, the gatherings, the cultural phenomena of ancient Greece. And no denying that we owe ancient Greece quite a bit. All cultures today do that. No sense of superiority. That's a sense of existence. Does the sun consider itself superior to the moon? It's a nonsensical question. Let me talk to you about some things that I've noticed, and give me some of your ideas back. I'd like to hear from you. I'm trying to puzzle things out and find some meaning. A little bit of music from the past, a little bit of music about the period, and something that will get us a little bit, you know, more than a little revved up. And that's what we're going to do with a few tunes today. William Shakespeare says, "We know what we are, but know not what we may be." Here's a little Bix Beiderbecke. This is from, he was playing with Paul Whiteman's orchestra somewhere between late 1926 and they broke up on January 9th of 1928. This is a tune called "There'll Come a Time." So just listen to a little sampler of it. There you go. Your great-grandmother tapped her foot to this. Thank you. Cheerful music, huh? World wars, in between the wars, isn't it? Picked up what they had and moved on. Solicitation. That would make a telemarketer blush. We didn't start like that, but it has crept in unrelentlessly to our function. Rather than approaching our work through the study of literature and history and philosophy and science, we have replaced landmarks with the conceits of limited minds. We are an order that talks without speaking, that hears without listening, that thinks without understanding. When did we replace the mentor and apprentice with merchant and customer? We are still trying to take the labor out of learning and craftsmanship. Not that seeking better means to accomplish a goal should be a bad thing. We've crossed a line doing that that has cost us too much. The tasks we teach require lessons to help us learn and understand patience, diligence, humility, authenticity, and honesty. We have removed the keyboard from the violin. A fingerboard. Apprentice Freemasons cannot practice the skills they need to achieve mastery of the craft because we have metaphorically removed and lowered expectations. We have handed out the answer sheet without teaching them how to calculate the answers for themselves. They come to us wanting to become a skillful artist, a skillful tradesman of the mind, of life. We've given them answers, but not without revealing that it takes effort. There is no free ride. It's not the conclusion. It's the travel to get there. It's not the destination. One would think contemplation would be a comfortable part of every lodge meeting. Not so much a practice in our lodges. We emphasize management by putting it first, ritual second, and relegate education to sound bites, if at all. How do we teach mind development without employing time-proven methods? I don't know. Let's at least use the parallels drifting in and out of memory. Shakespeare wrote in the 16th century work that is studied and admired around the world for showing people the capacity of mind and word to enrich the expression of human experience. We would need to confront the fear factors, arcane language, odd costume, and unfamiliar sentence structure that mirror Freemasonry, after all. The Oracle's indigestion has tracked us to the 21st century. Not so bad. Do I have to talk now as if sober-minded, reasonable people can't agree or disagree? Yeah, of course, don't agree with this. But it makes me wonder how, if we've even what what Johnson was calling one of the landmarks, memory work. We know that the Kabbalists would say memory work is a means to perfection. Today we look at it as an obstruction, or many do, as an obstruction that is pushing people away. People want that we, that's us. It's not them. We're streamlining, or we often hear that discussion. And you've heard it. I've heard it in Lodge by my seniors. It was embarrassing and discouraging to hear. But it also told me the problems have penetrated the walls for a long time. Because it didn't cause alarm or laughter. Not in the lodges I've been in. But it did get a reaction. Not thought out, just a reaction. As if it's always been there, we always have to do it. Again, kind of, it was a bit sad. The parallels are around us. If we don't teach the basics to our apprentices, we don't teach them that in order to get that smooth surface or that tonal quality that brings emotion to the ear of the listener, if we don't teach how much time it takes in order to gain that touch, then our apprentices are never going to learn. And some of them are bright enough to know that the stuff that we're shoveling at them are things they already know. That's not exactly the contract that we've offered. We're not here to teach people what they already know, but to take them to another level. Their level of ability, not our level of servitude. Their level of ability may well be quite different and beyond us, and hopefully so. Because we will face a real problem when we find somebody that has that kind of talent. They will stand out. They will be difficult. Not in the sense of anarchists, but in the sense of brilliance. They never quite fit in. So think about the order. What's happened to this? We emphasize business first. We stick it at the front of the meeting on the agenda. Is there a point to doing that? The only lodges where I see that the philosophy and principles are respected and understood are lodges where the business is handled completely apart, doesn't compete with anything. Yes, it's necessary. Of course it is. Don't be ridiculous. But when did we ever think that it was to be the dominant element on every agenda? Not only that, this frequent solicitation, hand in your pocket. Almost every single time a leader of our organization speaks, almost, it will come, and watch this for yourself, and prove me wrong, please, please, please. There is a tag on, and it's a solicitation. Do something. Do something else. And it's not one. Often you'll hear in meetings a list, or you'll hear 4 or 5 speakers advertising hawking their wares, hawking their events in advance so that they get the good turnout to make a profit. Well, you know, all by itself, how did that ever happen? I wish for the days of lodge meetings before golf tournaments were so prevalent. Not that I begrudge anybody making a profit and putting it toward good use. Don't get me wrong. And if you're thinking that, well, grow up. I don't operate that way. So I, really? That's got to be spoken about every single time? Well, the world is around. It has changed, and expectations of us have changed. We're no longer coming to meetings in a horse with a horse-drawn wagon. We no longer transfer news mouth to ear. It comes to us in packages. And every single package is surrounded by appeal to buy, to purchase, to give. The emphasis is on not the quality of our life, the experience of entertainment, but on commerce, money, currency. So the world around us has changed. The lives that we live are different. Not the important things in life, but the day-to-day, the mundane, the practical, the ordinary things of life. And it's ratcheted up even since we were boys. The flyer at the included with the mail. Do you remember when there were no flyers being delivered? Do you remember how old you were when they first started being inserted in the letterbox and mom would pick them up? Remember the person that would come to the door to sell? The intrusion might be the Fuller Brush Man knocking on the door. Oh, we had the tradesman, the Iceman, just before refrigeration came in, we had refrigeration that required blocks of ice to be sold, and the Iceman would come around. Then bakeries would come around with a truck, or in our community, a small horse-drawn wagon, deliver fresh baked goods. The milkman always came in the morning. He had a truck, so we had fresh milk. And we were on a schedule. And you put out your empty bottles and the full one would be left. Yeah. And then our telephones, those were used for our personal use. Now I'm hectored by a list of well-intended organizations all pleading a case relentlessly as if my privacy, my downtime doesn't matter, that I'm a captured audience. You have these same phone calls. When in the world did we start screening out telephone calls? That's shameful, but it happens. As if I'm not going to answer you. It's bad manners, of course, but think about the reason why it had to be. It was too much. Just too constant. And that doesn't make it go away. If you turn on the television, the footnotes now around it are constant streamers of ads. And now in our lodges, the ads, different category, you might say, it's all the same. And oh my goodness, we wonder why we're not appealing to a membership. Well, I'm part of a really nice lodge now, but it's a degree mill. You know, you know what I mean. Lodges that don't have a lot of degree work seem to have a mindset that they somehow failed. Not that it's an opportunity for the door to be closed to study and get into deep and thoughtful discussion. Not that it's a rare opportunity to control your time or to even limit who comes to the door or through the door. Nope. Come on in and we'll get you in here as fast as we possibly can. Because what? Do we need that extra nickel? We need somebody else. Well, look around. Those boys aren't staying. They're leaving us behind. Yeah, this is us. Solicitation. And we ramp it up. And it goes on constantly. Every single meeting. So, we've done a bait and switch. come in, come to the door, and we're an organization, the oldest and most august fraternal organization in the world. But we're not going to talk about the nature of fraternal organizations. So no, we're not going to talk about social philosophy or humanism. We're not going to, no. And don't bother bringing them up. We're here to talk about ritual, but not the meaning of it. Organization, but not the effect of it, purpose of it. And by the way, don't ask questions. This is about compliance. So should we be taken back a little bit? Yeah, oh, definitely. Definitely we should. Time to open our eyes just a little wider. It is not in the stars to hold our destiny, but in ourselves. That's up to us. Shakespeare helps us with this, but that's our destiny is not out there. It's not a we or they, it's us. Unbelievable. There is nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. We have, before we jump into all of this with value judgments, you know, we make, well, do I like that? Is that a good idea? Is that a comforting thought? Yes or no? Oh, I don't think I quite like that. It doesn't quite fit. You know, it squeezes my toes just a little bit. I don't think I care. Those are judgments. The big universe out there, things are what they are. That's where we can talk and examine them. The good, the bad, and the ugly. One touch of nature makes the whole world kind, says the bard. What do we see in nature? There's a good tree and a bad tree, a good ray of sun and a bad ray of sun, a good leaf and a bad leaf. Oh, the seasons, they're horrible, aren't they? Why? They are what they are. They are what they are. Here, listen to a little bit of this and see how Vivaldi, you remember he wrote The Four Seasons. And we've already heard a little bit of winter earlier. This is summer, so what could be more fitting? And see how he expresses that sense of coming into summer. You know, you're thinking that it's a riot of sound? Listen to how gentle he sees this. He interprets it for us. Just a little taste. Thank you. winter, summer storms that come and go and pass. And yeah, interesting, isn't it? That's Vivaldi, Antonio Vivaldi. That's homage to summer. Now, have you got? Are the women and children out of the room? I want to talk to you about. I'm going to talk a little bit about the first Freemasons, and thank Antonio Vivaldi. He was a very, very interesting writer. But anyway, we'll get into. We've got a little excursion into a Masonic composer coming up, of course. I'm shameless that way. I want to talk to you about alchemy and Freemasonry. Do you mind? Oh, don't claim that you didn't come to the door hearing a little bit about this. And I don't mean some of the weirdness that went on in the background that, you know, makes the tabloid news. We had that stuff. But that's, you know, that's just boyish, the boyish stuff going on in the background. I'd like to get the children out of the room and have a little conversation about alchemy. Yeah. And you need to know that at any moment, as I'm going through this, I could burst into flames. But I don't think so. Here, when a candidate, this is, I found this material by Timothy Hogan. Interesting. Interestingly, this is something he's written. He's a past master. He's, he wrote this about 2007. I put this out. So, you don't go anywhere with this topic without scratching the surface of dusting off some of the old books of the Masonic Order. And in one of the appendices that he gives is a translation by Sir Isaac Newton, 1680, the Emerald Tablet of Hermes, if you can imagine. So I don't know if we'll get into that today, but I'll talk to you a little bit. I just want to give you a little taste. So we're on the same page. When a candidate for Masonry says, this is goes through all of the various rituals of the many degrees composing the corpus of Freemasonry, they are confronted with many signs, symbols, gestures, and unalterable traditions, which may at first seem foreign. It is the hope of the Masonic institution that as the candidate progresses in degree work over the years and participates in the conferring of degrees, that he will come to understand the moral and esoteric implications of Masonic symbolism and will incorporate this new insight into his life. Sadly, however, many of the origins of these symbols have been lost and are now in hot debate by Masonic historians. As a result, the rituals are performed without most members understanding the full significance of what light is being conferred. I hope to show through this book that some of the origins of Masonic ritual go back to alchemical terminology and craftsmanship and allude not only to the transmutation of base metals into gold and elixir of life, but to the higher purpose of the transmutation of human character from a baser to a more noble and golden state. I hope to show that all the signs, symbols, lectures, and titles of the Masonic ritual owe their origin to the alchemical tradition, and that through a better understanding of these alchemical keys, a new science is open to the master craftsman, which can operate on the physical, mental, and spiritual levels of man's being. Fully expecting this hypothesis to be completely foreign to the average brother, we ask that all judgment be reserved until the case is completely presented. Please. The process and science of alchemy is a very arcane and difficult subject to present with people who are unfamiliar with it. In fact, it is even difficult to discuss with those who have studied it for years. So if you're raising questions, you're in good company, and you're the kind of mind that we've been searching for. We've been waiting for you to arrive. Good. Good. The word alchemy is generally believed to have come from Al-Kim, or from the land of Kim, which was Egypt. Even though most people associate alchemy with crazed magicians ingesting mercury and working in toxic fumes during the Middle Ages. The science of alchemy is actually quite ancient. Not only is it found in some of the oldest Egyptian texts, but we find it in the oldest Sumerian texts as well. In fact, the alchemical science of Sumer was called Grial, and is almost unquestionably the origin of the Holy Grail, or Grail tradition. This ancient history is covered extensively in the book called Revelation of the Holy Grail by Chevalier Emerys. His last name, E-M-E-R-Y-S, Chevalier Emerys. Alchemy was then fundamental to the institutions and philosophical schools of ancient Greece, and its doctrines were passed on by philosophers like Pythagoras, Plato, Socrates, and Aristotle. It was later propagated by the Essenes, early Muslims, Jewish Kabbalists, and the Knights Templar and cathedral builders in Europe. Finally, we also see it as the cornerstone of the works of people like Francis Bacon, Isaac Newton, Robert Boyle, Elias Ashmole, and others who developed the Royal Society of Britain. Freemasons like Benjamin Franklin and Voltaire and the Lodge of Nine Muses studied alchemy in relation to Freemasonry, and several Masons are also known alchemists, like the Comte de Saint-Germain, Cagliostro, General Joseph Warren, Paul Revere, Dr. Benjamin Rush, and Thomas Jefferson. Some would dispute Jefferson's involvement in Freemasonry since initiation records no longer survive for him. However, the record of him being present at several public Masonic events and the fact that a Masonic code cipher was found among his personal papers should attest to the fact that he had more than just a side interest in the fraternity. Franklin wrote in his Poor Man's Almanac of July 7, 1757, "Get what you can, and what you get, hold. 'Tis the stone that will turn all your lead into gold." Albert Pike also believed that alchemy was the great secret behind Freemasonry. All of these traditions had their part in the formation of Freemasonry, but as will be found in many of the excellent books on the history of Freemasonry. In a nutshell, alchemy can be defined as the process of taking something of a lower or lesser valued nature and transmuting it into something of a greater or more valuable nature. This process is always done through the action of heat or fire. On a physical level, it has been compared to turning lead into gold. On the moral level, in Masonic symbolism, it may be compared with turning the rough ashlar into the perfect ashlar through the heat produced by the action of the gavel of will. Psychologist Carl Jung equated it with turning from a will-less person to a self-actualized individual through the action of the heat of daily trials and tribulations. On a spiritual level, it relates to the individual coming to a closer understanding and connection with their God through right moral action, prayer, and meditation during times of hardship. All of these describe the alchemical definition, but in order to understand how directly it relates to Freemasonry, we need to describe the alchemical symbolism in the process of making the famed Philosopher's Stone, or the Grand Arcanum of alchemy, which turns base metals into gold, prolongs life, and stimulates consciousness. The first stage in the alchemical literature for the production of the Philosopher's Stone is for the master craftsman, the alchemist, to choose an herb with a particular affinity for what has been believed to be a planetary influence. The ancient alchemists recognized seven planets: the Moon, Sun, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Mercury, and Saturn. Each of these seven planets rule the respective day of the week, and our names of the days come from the Norse names for these planets. For example, Sun Day and Moon Day, Tuesday, that's Tuesday in Mars. Wotan's Day, Wednesday in Mercury. Thor's Day, Thursday in Jupiter. And Freya's Day, Friday in Venus. This planetary influence was believed to have corresponding associations in the body of the person, and by choosing an herb under the influence of, for example, the sun, it was believed that the sun ruled the heart, and therefore the herb could help heal a weak heart if a medicine was made of it on Sunday. An exact knowledge of the heavens above and the earth below was therefore needed to make correlations. Already the globes on the pillars come into perspective. The master craftsman also needed to know the seven liberal arts and sciences to perform this function. And it should not be surprising that in the ancient world, each of the seven liberal arts and sciences was ruled by one of the seven planets. After having found the herb needed, it was then pulled out of the ground by its roots, ground up as fine as possible with all parts intact, and put in a vessel with either dew collected in the morning or rectified spirits of wine. The dew allowed oils to separate from the herb, and these oils could be easily separated from the water, and the spirits of wine absorbed the oils and collected them that way. After the herb was ground up and had the liquid placed in a low water mark above it, it was caused to sit and digest for 24 hours, during which time it was shaken vigorously twice to help separate oils from the main body of matter in the vessel. As the green herb turned black, it was called by alchemists caput mortuum, which in Latin means dead head. It was the first stage of the alchemical process. It was then distilled seven times, a process which turned the liquid reddish and then into a vaporous air, and then caused it to fall in a purified form as a whitish or clear fluid substance. This separated the components of the herb, with the body of the herb remaining behind in one vessel, and the vital components of the herb containing oils of it being separated into another vessel. At the end of each distillation, oils from the herb were collected and were symbolically called the sulfur of the herb. The remaining liquid component of the herb was originally sitting in was said to contain the symbolic mercury, or life force that was believed to have come out of the air and been drawn into liquids like alcohol. The herb itself was said to have within it a special incorruptible body, which was symbolically called the salt of the herb. At the end of the seventh distillation, the oils and the other liquid were put in one vessel, and the remaining herb was put into another. The combined oil and liquid was then sometimes called heavenly dew in alchemical language. The final remaining herb body at the end of the final stage was now no longer called caput mortuum or deadhead, but rather known as feces, probably due to the fact that it had been completely digested in the vessel and now smelled with offensive effluvia. The final digestion occurs at the bowels of the vessel as all the liquid distilled away. The next step in the process involved taking the remaining herb and oils distilled out of it and burning them to ashes in a calcination dish or crucible. The ashes would at first turn black, but as more heat was added to the ashes with circulating air, the ashes would turn reddish in color. Symbolically, all of these processes culminated in the symbolic killing of the herb. Next, the master craftsman would take the reddish ashes, called salts, and would subject them to a special corrosive process with heat and the use of strong alkalis and acids, which would make the red salts turn into a bright white color. This white substance in alchemical terminology was called the secret salt, the spiritualized salt, the raised salt, and the hidden manna. It was secret salt because only the master craftsman would be able to look for it and find it, whereas others would throw it away, not knowing what they had. Thus, it was called the stone that the builders rejected. This raised salt was said to be the key ingredient to bring the refined essence of the herb back to life. It was believed to be hidden in everything and was thought to be of a special metallic nature. The seed of metals, though most people did not know how to look for it and therefore rejected it. Some of the largest concentrations of it were to be found in gold, grapes, pine, and wheat or corn. When Moses burned the golden calf into a white powder, the alchemists recognized it as a code for this substance. In fact, it was believed that any time the Bible alludes to white stone, manna, bread, or salt, that it was a code for this substance. The alchemists believed that Moses learned this technique from the Egyptians, as confirmed by the ancient historians Manetho and Flavius Josephus. The Egyptians described this substance in their texts, like the Egyptian Book of the Dead, also known as the Egyptian Book of Coming into Light, as a white powder, which they termed as a question. What is it? Manna in Hebrew likewise means what is it? In their hieroglyphics, the Egyptians showed it as a loaf of bread. Further in the Book of Jasher, one of the books removed from the Old Testament by early Jewish priests, it was Jethro, the metallurgist, who gave Moses the Ten Commandments of Yahweh, and not Yahweh himself. The alchemists believed that King Solomon knew the secret art of extracting this manna out of gold, which is why the Bible says that Solomon received 666 talents of gold each year in exchange for bread, and manna was also stored in the ark at his temple. We'll talk again a little bit more. It's not a very in-depth, but fascinating when we start to see meaning drawn out of these the terms that we've seen around us. Terms seen around us are, we don't know what to look for. It's not like we're looking necessarily in the wrong place. Do we recognize it when we see it? That's devilish, isn't it? That's devilish. Who knew that Johnson would find 44 landmarks? But nevertheless, landmarks you have. And I'm getting the message from people, this isn't a place to have lodge meetings out there in the media. But just take this back. This isn't where we get into the depth of it. Masonic Companion is for you if you're not getting out. And you don't have somebody around that can have that conversation with you. Well, sometimes we don't always want this. So this is at your beck and call, that conversation. Well, hopefully it's comfortable. We're going to wrap it up in a few minutes here. Here's the number 24th out of 44, as he wrote them. The foundation of a speculative science upon an operative science. And it's kind of uncanny when you think about us reading about alchemy. The foundation of a speculative science upon an operative art and the symbolic use and explanation of the terms of that art for the purpose of religious or moral teaching constitute another landmark. You get that? The foundation of a speculative science upon an operative art and the symbolic use and explanation of the terms of that art for the purposes of religious or moral teaching, constitute a landmark, another one. The Temple of Solomon was the symbolic cradle of the institution, and therefore the reference to the operative Freemason which constructed that magnificent edifice, to the materials and implements which were employed in its construction, and to the artists who were engaged in the building, are all competent and essential parts of the body of Freemasonry, which could not be subtracted from it without an entire destruction of the whole identity of the order. Hence, all the comparatively modern rites of Masonry, however they may differ in their respects, religiously preserve this temple history and these operative elements as the substratum of all their modifications of the Masonic system. The last and crowning landmark of all is that these landmarks can never be changed. Nothing can be subtracted from them. Nothing can be added to them. Not the slightest modification can be made in them. As they were received from our predecessors, we are bound by the most solemn obligations of duty to transmit them to our successors. Makes some sense. Interesting basis for discussion. Anybody that claims to be speaking, you know, valid history into is really, as you can see, jumping to conclusions. So now a little bit of context at least you'll have. Here's an interesting question. Why should a Masonic lodge be closed at a reasonable hour? Well, remember, I'm a grumpy old guy, and I don't like, you know, time wasted fooling around, and, you know, people making jokes. It's like you've got, you know, 40 or 50 or 100 people sitting there listening. If I wanted a joke, I'd turn on Letterman. It is a fact conferred by experience that an indulgence in late hours cannot fail to injure the credit and respectability of a lodge, because it introduces other habits which are not consistent with the gravity and decorum which always ought to characterize the proceedings of Masonry. I like that. And hence it is an important part of the worshipful master's duty to discountenance any such baleful practice. If the brethren meet for the purpose of business or to cultivate a knowledge of the science by joining in the lectures, let them pursue their labors with assiduity and zeal during the period prescribed in the bylaws. And should it be necessary for the junior warden to perform his office, let the brethren enjoy themselves with decent moderation, but by all means let the senior warden discharge his duty honestly and conscientiously, and let the lodge be closed and the brethren depart to their homes at such an hour as shall excite no unpleasant feelings, nor call forth reproachful observations from the females of their family, whom it is their duty and interest, as well in the character of husbands and fathers as of Masons, to love, to cherish, and to oblige. So I don't know if I've seen bylaws that say the meeting will go from this time till that time. Man, would I love to. So many of them seem to drag on half an hour, 45 minutes, an hour longer for nothing. There's that term. Let them pursue the labors with assiduity. Let the brethren enjoy themselves with decent moderation. And let the lodge be closed and the brethren depart to their own homes at such an hour as shall excite no unpleasant feelings. Well, I see fellas getting up at the break and leaving. And the young masters are never taught. Never taught. Nobody pays any attention. Just goes on. Sad. Sad, eh? Of what is the brazen laver emblematic? It gets into definitions, eh? Moses was directed to make, among other articles of furniture for the services of the tabernacle, a laver of brass. It was held as a vessel of great sacredness in which water was kept for the ablutions of the priests before entering upon the actual discharge of their sacred duties of offering sacrifices before the Lord. In the ancient mysteries, the laver with its pure water was used to cleanse the neophyte of the impurities of the outer world and to free him from the imperfections of his past or sinful life. It is a necessary article in many of the higher degrees for the ablution of the candidate in his progress to a higher and purer system of knowledge. And we see that in most of the degrees. This is a process that our native Canadians, our First Nations, would know as smudging or sweetgrass ceremony. It's the ritual cleansing of the mind, of the tongue, of the ears, of the eyes, so that we speak and see and listen for truth. and that our bodies are cleansed ritually. For a long time, I was with an organization. We started the day. The staff and all of the people involved in the program with a ritual cleansing. It was absolutely amazing and wonderful. What a beautiful way to, I have to subscribe to it if you've never done it. But it was that cleansing that we talk about here with a brazen labor. So let that be a lesson. Let that be a lesson. And summertime, check this out. This is a tune by our friend, our brother George Gershwin. I've upgraded it a little bit here for your sake, but just see what you think. This is from Porgy and Bess. Hmm? That was a girl that died at 26. One of those singers from that era of social awareness in the 60s, phenomena that challenged the status quo, searching for meaning in a world at the time that seemed to have not met the needs of young people. Discord, detachment. See what the translation and interpretation of the words of a Mason. The music was Gershwin's. The lyrics were another man's. But, wow. Anyway, we're going to have to wrap up soon. I don't like saying goodbye, but show's coming to an end, and I don't want it. I've had a tendency to stretch it out a little bit too long, I think. When I'm talking about a meal that has to be savored in small bites, it's just wrong-minded of me to be carrying on as if this is a banquet and you just should be sitting there and just hunker down and keep feeding at it and feasting at it until because you're captured in the air. Well, we'll get into the first Freemasons, Scotland's early lodges and their members. You know, we'll eventually get there. Don't worry. Don't worry. I'll play you out with a little music from Three Boys. So a hopeful little tune. That stuff about solicitation, it's not like we point fingers and say, oh man, you know, all of this is wrong. It's like, what do we do? How do we sort this out? If we're going to run ads, I think we need to respect that and not be schlepping and sticking it in, you know, when you've got people captured and all of a sudden, you know, has anybody have anything for the good of blah, blah, blah. And there you've got a captured audience and you drop kick them, don't you? Right in the chest. Oh, and by the way, we have this going on and that going on this date, and I've got tickets here. And then the next fellow stands up and does exactly the same thing. Really? That's how you want to treat our members? Do the hard sell when they're captured and you're expecting happiness and cooperation and high attendance? Give your head a shake. The rush to the door is going on a little too long to ignore this stuff. But hey, easier to push me in front of the bus than to deal with it. These boys are from New Jersey. They're called Sleepy Mountain Banjo Boys. And I think it's impossible to be depressed and listen to this kind of music. See what you think. I look forward to being with you again incredibly soon. Committing acts of random Masonic kindness is what we do. Cheers.
Tonight we're going to play you two songs, and we're three brothers from New Jersey. And the funny thing is that, believe it or not, we are hooked on bluegrass, and we're excited to play it for you tonight. Thank you.
See, I told you, you just can't be grumpy and sad when you hear bluegrass music. Come back soon. We'll have a blast.
We call ourselves the Sleepy Man Banjo Boys.
Thank you.